Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of Postgame, SideQuest Patreon podcast all about hot takes on cold games. I'm Melissa. I'm SideQuest editor-in-chief. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm here with the other two editors. The other two. I'm the important one. I'm just kidding. I'm not the important one.
We love you this week.
We think you're very important.
Thank you. I'm not more important, though.
Okay. I accept your egalitarian approach to leadership. Hi, my name's Zora. I use they, them pronouns. I am the assistant editor and copy ogre.
I am Nassim. I use they, them pronouns, and I am the managing editor.
All very important roles. Today, we are talking about games. I know. It's wild. Zora, you can read your description, because I don't want your words out of my mouth.
All right. So for this episode, we're talking about games, baby.
Thank you. I wanted to hear it.
That's right, all of them, and what it means to be one. We like to set low bars for ourselves. They're achievable. We are not proposing a PhD, and we're certainly not proposing something that would be out of scope even for a PhD. This is a normal discussion to have in an hour.
Yes.
But I am interested. Speed run my dissertation. I'm not getting a dissertation in games. That's not in the cards. What happened is I was on Twitter, and then my roommate went, "Hey Zora, this thread is really cool," and sent me to a different part of Twitter, where somebody, John Briger, I believe, at Das Briger, D-A-S Briger on Twitter, wrote a thread about Candyland and how Candyland is like a really masterful example of game design for a specific audience. And people in the comments were like, it's not a game. And I went, okay, that's interesting. you know, there's a discussion here. Obviously, there's a discussion here. People are constantly talking about what a game is and more specifically what video games are. But I'm particularly interested in... So for me, defining game is very easy. It's something that you play. Which, of course, leads to another question, which is, what is play? And so that's more specifically what I think we're going to try to talk about today is how we define play and how different factors kind of influence the experience of play. And we're going to do all of that at a very high level, or we're going to do one really specific part of it at a very deep level. And we don't know which yet. We'll find out as we go.
Join us.
I love it. This topic has also been on my mind a lot recently, just because I played Field Guide to Memory and I'm currently playing Genesis Noir, both of which are games as I would define them, but I think there could be some contention, like not in like the people playing Field Guide to Memory know what Field Guide to Memory is and are not going to be like, this isn't a game. But if it's if it suddenly became like, oh, everyone should play Field Guide to Memory, I think there would be some pushback on it. And I can describe what it is later. And I have already seen in terms of Genesis Noir, like, is this really a game? Because, like, it's just a lot of clicking. Like, you don't do anything. So, like, is it a game? So I've been thinking about that a lot with regard to the two games that I'm playing. So I'm very excited to have this conversation.
Great. Yeah. I come to this from specifically, like, the TTRPG space. People... In like discussions about tabletop role-playing games, I see people like talking about how there's a lot of it frustrates them when they have to have a lot of mechanical discussions because they just want to get to the play. And I also listen to a lot of Friends at the Table. I don't want to talk about how much Friends at the Table I listen to, but they have a Patreon like podcast that they call Tips at the Table, where they sort of answer gaming questions. And at one point, one of the answers that Austin Walker, who is the host of Friends at the Table and used to be EIC of Waypoint at Vice, he says that he considers those mechanics discussions part of play. And I thought that was really, really interesting. And it stuck in my brain in a really significant way. And I think informs kind of how I come to this discussion of play. Not just because this guy said it, but also because it matched something that I had not articulated about my interest in these games that are so very different from what we think of as like board games or video games because of how they're collaborative specifically.
To kind of piggyback off of that, I recently interviewed the designers of Field Guide to Memory, Jian Shim and Xingyan Kor. And I asked a question, and this my interview with them will be up on the site eventually, hopefully by the time this comes out. The interview is 26 pages long, so, you know. But I mentioned in there that Field Guide to Memory, I'll go ahead and give just a very brief summary, is a journaling game where you create a journal from the perspective of the mentee of Dr. Elizabeth Lee, who is a cryptid researcher who has gone missing. And you do this by responding to journaling prompts and letters of correspondence and that kind of thing that come to your character as if your character were a real person. It's really beautifully designed, and I really, really loved it. And Xingyan Kor and Jian Shim coined the terms keepsake game and connected path game to kind of describe the goals of what they were doing in Field Guide to Memory. And I wanted to interview them about that. And while we were talking, I mentioned that Field Guide to Memory, in not relying on like a specific skill or chance or dice rolls or randomness, really, there's like one, I remember distinctly one point when you flip a coin, which determines which piece of correspondence you'll respond to. But otherwise, I don't remember any randomness. And so I asked them, like, this doesn't feel like what people would normally anticipate a game feeling like, because there isn't this feeling of like it's up, like it's some way you have to like defeat it. Like you don't have to. Mm-hmm. You don't have to respond to randomness or any of that kind of stuff. And I'm like, that it actually put me more in the mind of make-believe than of like what we normally think of as games, which is not to say it's not a game, just that it is a little bit different. And they both pointed out that like a lot of times we associate mechanics with dice rolls or skill points or whatever. And they're like, actually, everything you do in Field Guide is a mechanic. Journaling is your mechanic. The emails are your mechanic. The way we designed the game is mechanics. And talking in some of their games that are coming up, Amending is a game that uses embroidery to play.
Mm-hmm.
Embroidery is the mechanic. They're like, I think we need to get outside of our normal framing of mechanics as, you know, cards or dice, and more so as whatever you do within the play space. This is kind of my reading into what they said. These aren't their words. So don't, if you disagree, please don't at them. You can at me. But I found that really interesting because I think there's so much versatility in mechanics that we don't really think of. And I think referring back to what you said that Austin Walker said on the podcast, I think that's very true. Like character creation and leveling up and all that kind of stuff is also very fun for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of my enjoyment of games like this, just as the journaling and making, you know, pressed leaves and that kind of stuff while playing Field Guide to Memory was all part of my experience. And it was still playful, even though it's not what we normally think of as play.
Nassim, do you have anything to add about, like, I guess your relationship to play or your thoughts on play coming into this? Yeah. I know that you interviewed Bo Ruberg for the site, right?
That I happened? Did.
Okay.
Yeah, I interviewed them for their latest book, The Queer Games Avant-Garde, for Bitch Media, and then was like, hey, can I also use this on SideQuest? And they were like, sure. And my editors at Bitch were like, sure. So I got to also use that material for that, for this stuff.
The thing that I think about it's been interesting listening to the two of you and kind of thinking through this conversation, because I think personally, on some level, I tie together ideas of play and fun with pleasure, although I don't think these things necessarily have to be tied together, and I think we will be talking about that. But, you know, I might play around with some ideas or play with some sort of paints or art stuff and derive enjoyment from this, but, you know, does that ultimately mean something for the larger ideas of play? Like, for me, I think about play and I associate with this idea of, like, a childhood sense of wonder and openness and exploration. And I personally derive pleasure from those things. So yeah, I kind of link these things together, and I don't know if I have like clearer thoughts than that, but I definitely am interested in thinking about like how playment and senses of fulfillment come together.
Yeah, I think so this is going off some notes that we wrote in response to specifically the question, what does it mean to play? Which so easy to answer. And I as I said before, I think I take a very, very broad view of what play is or what it means to play. Part of that is due to my background. I did my undergrad in linguistics, and specifically sociolinguistics, and the way we approached language was very descriptivist, which is to say our approach to language was to describe how it was used rather than to prescribe how it should be used, right? Mm-hmm. So it was observational as opposed to normative. And when I'm trying to define a word, which is a very, very difficult thing to do if you're not a dictionary, I mean, supposedly it is also very, very difficult to do if you are a dictionary. But when you get into like linguistics study and you look at pragmatics and you look at semantics and you look at like language as used, it becomes more complicated because there's all this like connotative meaning that goes into each use of a word, not just like the definitional meaning of the word itself. Anyway, so when I start thinking about a word, I think a lot about how I use it and how I've heard it used. And when I think of play specifically, you know, I go to play a video game. I go to, play with a friend, with friends. We're not talking about that. That's a noun. It's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the verb.
Penny has now arrived under my microphone. I'm really sorry if you hear bumping and or purring, but this does get her to stop meowing.
She's hello, there. Eventually what I arrived at is a phrase that I use a lot, which is playing around in a space, right? So it's and that space, I use that space to refer to basically anything. You know, I use it to refer to I use it most to refer to like kind of conceptual spaces. So right now we are playing around in the space of like, you know, discussing what a game is, of defining game. It's a very, very broad definition, but I feel that it's also very true to how I conceptualize play because it's sort of like this low stakes exploration in pursuit of something fulfilling. My first instinct is always go to fun because I find this fun. I find this kind of like freewheeling exploratory discussion very interesting, but also you can have play that accesses, and this goes into one of Bo Ruberg's plays or pieces that we read, which is, hang on, sorry about the rustling.
I love it.
I took notes on paper, y'all. It's 2005. Bonnie Ruber's piece, No Fun, The Queer Potential of Video Games That Annoy, Anger, Disappoint, Sadden, and Hurt. And so I'm not just talking about video games here, but the idea echoes, you know, Ruberg in this piece talks about no fun emotions, which are those that I've listed, annoy, anger, disappointment, sadness, and hurt. And I think that play can elicit the play as I use it can elicit those emotions, and those are actually very, very important emotions, especially when you're thinking about like exploratory play. But ultimately there's this pursuit of some sort of fulfillment of having gained something from the experience that you didn't have before. And this is a very broad definition, which is very funny because one of the things that I took issue with while reading these pieces was that Bonnie Ruberg uses like a really, really broad definition for queer, which is fine. I don't want to like get super into that, but it was like a given in the pieces that made me squint. And so now I'm just like, yes, play can also mean many, many things.
Oh, Penny. Yeah, I found myself, I've never really thought about like what play means to me before the question was put before me for this very episode. I think coming into this conversation, I did have like a somewhat narrow definition of play for myself. But I think that has been broadening recently, especially just with the games that I have been playing, like Field Guide to Memory and Genesis Noir. And I it's not something I had thought about until the question was put before me. And when the question was put before me, I realized that my definition is a lot more broad than I thought. and like, I don't know, I put this in the outline. This is maybe like too a little too out there as far as this conversation is going, but like, I've always had a resistance to the term gamer for a variety of reasons, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's a lot of reasons not to identify.
Of what one might call ideographic weight put towards
yeah.
that. And it's been so yeah. long that I don't really know how to define ideograph anymore.
I get but, it by feel.
Great.
You know?
Excellent.
But so I've always had this resistance to the term gamers for a variety of reasons, like, in, you know, everything that has become associated with the word gamers. But even before, like, I had really a concept of what that meant, I would not have called myself a gamer for, you know, I didn't play a lot of games, or I didn't play the right games or anything like that. But I've never had that problem with player, right? Like, I feel like the association between the idea of a person who plays and versus a person who games is distinct to me. And I feel a whole lot more comfortable with the idea of myself as a person who plays rather than as a person who games, because I feel like those are two distinct ways of approaching play.
Yeah.
Like, gamer has, to me, the connotation of almost optimization or achievement, whereas that's not how I play.
Yeah. Yeah, there's I think there's like layers of stuff happening there, which is the academic way to say I don't really know what's happening there, but I have thoughts, but I have guesses. And I yeah. think part of it is that one, there's so much like cultural contextual weight to put upon the idea of being a gamer, just because it conjures up discourse, capital D discourse. But mm-hmm. also it is an identity culturally, even if we don't like look at all of the discourse around, you know, capital G gamers, or the fact that in indexes directly into Gamergate, or any of that. Like, people identify as gamers, right? It is an identity label that people purposefully put upon themselves, that they self-identify with. Whereas player, as it's used in like contemporary speech in general, inside and outside of gamer communities, is a role, a very specific role that typically has a relationship to the game that is not simply like engaging with it. Right. So like, to be a gamer, you are somebody who games, you are somebody who plays games. There's this idea of like commitment or habituality to it. There's like a commitment almost inherent in the identity. Whereas to be a player, you are a player of a game, right? Mm-hmm. To no matter what game you're playing, or with how much commitment you have to it, when you pick up the controller, you have become a player of the game automatically. Similarly, when you're playing a tabletop RPG, when you engage with the RPG and you play a character, or you start like role-playing according to the rules as set out by the game, you're a player. You can have a discussion maybe about whether or not the GM is a player. I think very, very strongly that the GM is, mm-hmm. but there are people who would disagree with me. But regardless, you know, that being a player kind of presupposes that there is a specific game that you are a player of, whereas being a gamer is like a state of mind, baby.
I really feel like you can be a gamer without playing, but I don't know that mm-hmm. you can be a player without a game.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. And I think it's very funny and interesting. And I think you can play without being a gamer.
Yes, absolutely. It's yeah, it was something that like I was sitting there thinking about play, and I was reading these essays by Bo Ruberg, and there was like use of the word gamer, and I was like, I wouldn't apply that word to myself, again, for a variety of reasons, but this idea of play and playing games is very compelling to me, and it's interesting to me about me. That I would situate myself as a person who plays rather than as a person who games as a verb.
All of this is... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, never mind. It wasn't important. Oh,
okay. No, I think all of this is also particularly funny because the episode that we just published, which was our My First Game episode, I titled it Gamer for Life. off of something that I specifically said early on in the podcast. And also I said very facetiously. because I feel the same way. I wouldn't particularly ascribe the identity gamer to myself. But I do think that I've spent much of my life in play, and even in play of video games specifically. And that's I don't know. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't have a conclusion.
I totally agree. It's just interesting to me. Nassim, please. Do you have thoughts?
Thoughts
on being a player or a gamer?
I think it's interesting because for me, hearing the word gamer definitely does evoke video games specifically. And when Zora was talking about tabletop games, they are a form of play, right? But I the way that I conceptualize the word gamer, I definitely don't think of when you're doing a TTRPG, you are playing a game.
I'm absolutely going to start saying I'm a gamer. And when people are like, what do you play? I'm going to be like, Apocalypse World. And they're going to be like, what's that? And I'm going to be like, okay, it's this really cool system. You roll 2d6. It really kind of was part of ushering in this new age of indie RPGs. And whoever I'm talking about is going to be like, okay.
I love it.
I love it too. But I find that to me is interesting too. That it feels almost I don't know whose legitimacy, but a term of legitimacy, right? Oh, you're a capital G gamer, which is silly. I mean, but that's I think a lot of part when you were talking about identity stuff, that does come from a place of someone gatekeeping and or at least the way that I'm hearing it, who gets to be these terms, and then choosing not to identify with that is a direct shul of that-ness.
Yeah, the implicit values of the people who typically and loudly hold the identity.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't know if I have anything more coherent than that, but that's certainly what came to mind as I was listening.
I feel like I've hijacked this podcast in the name of sociolinguistic analysis.
No, I love
it. I'm sorry.
No,
it's interesting, these words have weight and they have meaning. You know?
Yes,
so
yeah,
I think
exactly.
that is how you, it makes sense to approach it that way.
I mean, this is what I was, when I was talking about ideographs before, an ideograph in my admittedly dim memory, I've been out of college for 4 years, it's been a minute, an ideograph is a word that holds cultural contextual weight and signals into value systems that are supposedly held by both the speaker and the audience. And I learned this word in the context of American politics, wherein the ideographs for different political audiences, different political groups are different, right? So when we talk about being family oriented and I'm going to talk about Democrats versus Republicans because this is the context in which I talked about it before. I've moved past that sort of political conceptualization since. But anyway, so when you know, Democrats talk about family values and when Republicans talk about family values, they're talking about different family values. And so family mm-hmm. values is this phrase that holds a very, very strong ideographic weight for both groups. But the ideograph is different. Between groups. And so with gamer, we don't quite have that difference problem. It means a pretty similar thing to lots and lots of people, but whether we find that thing to be appealing or something that we want to engage with strongly differs between groups.
I'm thinking of the kind of person who would call me a gamer. I'm the only thing I can think of is
grandparents, right?
Yeah, my grandparents yeah. would call me a gamer. And so if somebody were to call me a gamer, I would assume that they are either my age and being ironic or old.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only two people I could think of that would call me a gamer.
Yeah. And it's and I think when we talk about play and what makes a game, I think that you're going to get different average, quote unquote, average definitions from people like us who primarily don't identify ourselves as gamers despite playing a not insignificant number of video games.
Just a few.
And or tabletop role-playing games, which I play more of.
I do now.
So you're going to get a different definition from us than you're going to get from communities that very, very strongly identify with the word gamer or self-identify as gamers. And that kind of gets into, again, why I wanted to have this conversation, because of that divide that I was seeing between John Briger's tweet, where he talks about Candyland as this masterpiece of game design, and some replies to that tweet for people whose names I am not going to mention because I don't like them quite so much. You know, one should be credited for their ideas, but sometimes those ideas are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and it a reply to this tweet said that this whole thread feels like semantics on what constitutes a game. If your definition of a game is mutually exclusive with a predetermined outcome, Candyland is not a game by default. That doesn't make it uninspired or unimportant, simply not a game. Now, I don't disagree with the idea that depending on how you define things, different things will fall under the label.
Mm-hmm.
However, this tweet is phrased such that I get the idea that Dan Coleman does not believe that a game with a predetermined outcome is a game. And I disagree with Dan Coleman.
And I not to argue about this very specific point, mm-hmm. but does Candyland have a predetermined outcome? Because anyone can conceivably win.
Yeah, I'm...
There's elements of chance, right?
Anyone can conceivably win, but the win state is the same. You know, it's one path. I don't believe it branches. Run along it by rolling a die with a bunch of colors on it, and when you get a color, you move to that color square, and so on, and you know, you rotate around.
I'm sorry, I'm incensed by this definition.
Oh my god, I'm so sorry.
I'm just really baffled, because that means that, thinking about our most basic concepts for what constitutes a game, like Super Mario Bros. Is not a game.
No, I agree. Like, this idea that just because something, but it's so many, I feel like so many games we play as children are like classic board games. Don't they all kind of fall under that same premise?
I mean, I feel I should mention that Dan Coleman does not ever say confirm that his definition of a game is this thing that he's said.
I see.
But the dismissiveness of the tweet on the first tweet of a thread that goes into why Candyland is an interesting game experience felt an almost offensively dismissive approach to this sort of exploration of game spaces that I winced, I guess. it set me off thinking about what play is specifically.
Yeah, when I think about my childhood experiences playing Candyland, I don't remember a single game of Candyland, and on an individual level, right? I don't remember that time that I did it like this, but I do remember the imaginative space that Candyland created. In terms of I saw these interesting character designs, and you can read the backstory and all this kind of stuff. And it created an imaginative play space for me in which I could come up with explanations for why things happened the way they did, or why the character looked like that, or what that character's design suggested to me. As there was some character who I found very scary. I think it was the licorice one. I don't know if the licorice one is
let me go look at these images, because there's one that there's just a queer coded villain.
Is it the peppermint one?
There's the 1949 Candyland, which is mostly just environmental drawings. And then the 1980s Candyland introduces Lord Licorice, the queer coded licorice villain.
Okay, yes. Licorice was the licorice person as a child, I am no longer a child, a child who is, there I go again, very Scandinavian. I was appalled that they would make the licorice character the villain. I fucking love licorice, and everybody wants to hate on me for loving black licorice.
Oh my god.
You can have all the licorice. Go for it.
Yeah. So actually, I am the villain, because I collect all of the licorice and hoard it for myself. Anyway. The character designs and stuff gave me this imaginative space to play in, and that itself feels game to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like that that mm-hmm. feels like a game, even though like the activities of the game itself were not the draw. Same with Pretty yeah. Pretty Princess. Big one in my grandparents' house. We were all about that Pretty Pretty Princess life.
I don't think I've ever played that one, which I assume is a similarly like meandering narrative approach to game.
You have to collect all the jewelry, and if you get the black ring, then you can't win. You have to get rid of the black ring.
Oh.
Yeah, I used to play it with my grandpa. Yeah, I used to play it with my grandpa all the time and kicked ass.
That's very cute. But, that your grandpa would play with you.
Yeah, it was really, really cute. But the like both of these games, which are fairly boring to play as adults, like I'm mm-hmm. not whipping out. I had Pretty Pretty Princess for some reason as an adult. I think a friend picked it up and was like, take it. I literally never pulled it out of the closet to play because as an adult, it's boring. Mm-hmm. I have better games to play. But as a kid, it was this imaginative like activity to do with my family. And that to me feels like a game. It's the stage upon which we play, you know. It is not dissimilar to me to the way that I play tabletop RPGs, where mm-hmm. they give me a set of rules and I get to decide what the fun to be had inside of those rules is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's just that yeah. that one is a little more sophisticated than the other, I suppose.
And I think that that's like a really essential kind of play. I mean, people should play the way that they enjoy playing, but I think that rejecting sort of narrative exploration approaches to play is like fundamentally limiting your view of what play can be in a way that's not particularly like helpful to the person doing the limiting, nor to anybody that they interact with. I think it really like it reduces a lot of really like the potential for a lot of really rich and interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Missy, I have a pitch for you. Not a piece of writing. I'm sorry. I have a video or a board game to pitch you.
Ooh, what is it?
It's called Ladies and Gentlemen. It's aggressively gender normative. but it's a really delightful game. It's a team based game. It's teams of two. You play either a lady or a gentleman, and your team is made up of a lady and a gentleman. And the gentlemen have a little, like, kind of speed puzzle situation in which they try to generate wealth. And then, meanwhile, the ladies go shopping. So, like, again, the gendering, it's a nightmare. But it can be a very, very fun game to play with your friends who have a similarly dismissive view of the hetero patriarchal system, and it can be fun to pair up and like get sort of into the role playing of being like these snotty high society people who are trying to win.
I love it. I have added a note to put it into my game jar.
It's not a video game, it is a board game. I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I have video games and tabletop games in my
okay.
in my jar.
It's also not a tabletop game. It is fully a board game. It has pieces.
Okay. No worries. I can still get that. I think there's card games and stuff in my
okay, great.
In my jar.
It's super fun. I can only play it sometimes because I really have to get over the gender thing whenever I engage with it.
Fair.
But it's like when you were talking about Pretty Pretty Princess and if you had the black ring, you lose. I was like, oh, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, man, I could write a whole fucking essay about Pretty Pretty Princess and like how cool that was. Maybe I will. Anyway.
Sounds like a pitch.
Maybe. Anyway, but I think both of these are like examples of play where like Ladies and Gentlemen is actually it's a competitive game. It doesn't have a predetermined outcome. I mean, I guess it does. You shop, but but there's many possible outcomes, many possible winners, many possible ways to win. There's a small element of skill, there's elements of chance. You know, it's got all of the gamey things that people, it's indisputably a game. But my fun when playing it comes primarily from the interactions I have with my friends and the fact that it essentially provides us with an improv scenario.
Mm-hmm.
In which it's playing Ladies and Gentlemen today, or sorry, not today, Playing Ladies and Gentlemen for me taps into a lot of the parts of my brain that Fiasco taps into. And if you don't know, Fiasco is a tabletop role-playing game in which you play overblown characters who make bad decisions.
Very bad decisions.
And Ladies and Gentlemen very much feels like I go into the play mode when I play Ladies and Gentlemen that I go into when I play Fiasco, which is like kind of like indexing into these like broad tropish characters, relying on kind of punching up stereotypes. So this not particularly kind image we have of affluent high society types, and just sort of like really leaning into the petty bullshit that comes with that. Similarly, I expect I would have fun playing similar roles in The Good Society, which is a Jane Austen RPG. Anyway, but these are all play. It's all very different play, but it's all definitely play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about, like, again, just like this, having this question posed to me, I think was really beneficial. So if you have not had this question posed to you, you should think about it, just because it's like, huh, I never thought about that. And it's like really enlightening for me to think mm-hmm. about like what mm-hmm. that means. One of the kind of guiding questions we had for this was like, how does competition affect mm-hmm. the experience of play? And initially, like if I hadn't thought about it, and like if I didn't have a game like games like Field Guide to Memory or Genesis Noir on the brain, I might have thought, well, I don't know, maybe some degree of competition is necessary. But playing Field Guide to Memory, I'm not in competition with anybody, and I was quite deliberately not in competition with anybody, which is explained more in depth in my review. But I had a hesitation about doing something like journaling, because so many people make such beautiful ones, especially in the context of Field Guide to Memory. Like, there's a hashtag you can browse and they're all beautiful. And so I would have normally been in competition either with myself or with other people, just in terms of like, well, if mine doesn't look as beautiful as theirs, then what's the point? Mm-hmm. But kind of freeing myself from that, yeah. from that level of competition increased mm-hmm. my enjoyment of the game and made me realize that it's much easier to make a thing that I care about, even if it's not as beautiful as I want it to mm-hmm. be. So after some deliberation, my answer to myself is no, competition is not necessary. I tend to, my first instinct, like, you know, your like gut reaction, that feeling is like, yes, it requires a level of risk or chance or something like that. But then when I actually spend some time on the question, I'm like, no, it super doesn't to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You come up with counterexamples.
Yeah.
I think
yeah. Go ahead.
Somebody other than me, I've talked so much.
I was going to say that when I was thinking of competition, like one of the things that I thought, because I also like, I enjoy games that like, the game is cooperative, right? Like the one that, mm-hmm. that sprung to mind, even though there is a competitive element in this, Dead of Winter sprung to mind for me. But because the thing I was thinking about is like competition drives the sort of goal orientedness of a game, right? And the idea that you're driving towards the end as opposed to, and again, like this is not necessarily precludes the process, but it feels to me that by having some sort of competition or goal, you're thinking about that as sort of like the, you know, quote unquote end game. And I think like, again, I'm sorry, just like take your talking points, or I'm not trying to, but I was responding to one of your things where you mentioned like the idea of stakes with this.
Mm-hmm.
Because
I remember writing that down. So go wild.
You know, like the idea of a goal potentially, or like the competition driving up the stakes. And so when I was thinking of Dead of Winter, like for me, even though there are like the competitive element, and this is incidentally for people who haven't played, Dead of Winter is a zombie board game that's mostly cooperative and has some competitive elements. But like for me, the thing that drives the stakes in that game is just surviving zombies, because I find zombies scary, even though that is also technically the end game, right? Like you're supposed to win by not losing to the zombies, but what the scenario is what like drives the stakes for me there. But I do think that like there's so much, like, you know, Missy, you mentioned make-believe earlier, and that's like the one of the first forms of play that we experience as children, right? Mm-hmm. And there isn't a goal in make-believe. You're like having fun, you're building a world and experience together.
Yeah, this reminds me, like this kind of brings to mind just something that has long confused me, which is that I love to play tabletop RPGs, and I'm almost always the DM in my friend group, mm-hmm. Just because I am. And I have, you know, GM'd a few different games for my group, and I have discovered that some of them I am good at and some of them I am very, very bad at. The really bad one being Call of Cthulhu. I cannot GM Call of Cthulhu. I'm terrible at it. And this conversation has really kind of made me realize why that is. And it's because I am not interested in the competitive angle of tabletop games, where you can have emphasis on can, have almost an adversarial relationship between, in D&D, for example, the DM and the players, where the players are trying to defeat whatever the DM is throwing at them. When I DM D&D, my goal is to craft a compelling story with everybody else, which is why I suck at GMing Call of Cthulhu. That is, like, by design, an adversarial experience.
Yeah, Call of Cthulhu is very much meant to be adversarial.
Yeah, and I was terrible at GMing it. I gave everybody way too much power, and all of the horror was ripped from the game. And when you take the horror out of that game, it's just simply not very fun anymore.
I think it's interesting to look at... Oh, no, you should finish your thought, because I was about to go into the weeds about adversarial, like, table.
I lost you for a second. Can you...
Still... I'm sorry. No, I think I tapped the mute button by accident. I was just about to go into the weeds about tabletop RPGs and how they set up, like, GM relationships to players. Because you can... Nope, not going to do it. Sorry. Finish your thought.
when I'm approaching... I think that I have not played, like actually played, not as a GM, as a character, like had a PC in D&D more than one time. I've always been a GM. I have played Pathfinder as a character very briefly, but for the most part, I've always been a GM. And I think that the kind of person that I am and the way I play tabletop RPGs, I think I might understand some of the frustrations with D&D as a system if I had played it more and not GM'd it as much as I do, because I think that my approach to D&D may be very different from the way that a lot of DMs would approach it. Like thinking of the game that I'm playing right now, I play and I DM because the group kept dying. So I play a himbo cleric, and he's Excellent. Very bad. He's very bad at everything. I designed him to be bad. And we're starting a new game where I get to play a character. And I've once again designed a bad character. Like, he's going to be bad at what he does. And that is fun to me, to play somebody who serves maybe a strong narrative function, but not at all a mechanical one. Mm-hmm. That's more compelling to me, and I think that maybe if I had played more D&D, I would have less fun with it.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about my experiences with D&D, which four wasn't even out yet. I played most of my D&D in 3.5 in 2010. Maybe 4 was out, but we like summarily rejected it. And playing it was very much like, it was incredibly frustrating to be a character who was not competent in the thing that was the main like challenge that day. And part of that was my DM, you know, we were all 14, so we all sucked. And my DM was like specifically very interested in like giving us puzzles and having us solve them. It was your like standard mediocre high school D&D experience, right? Mm-hmm. But also the book, and I read a lot of it, does not encourage collaborative narrative play, or it, you know, the 3.5 book didn't. I think the 5e book is different. I think they've incorporated a lot more like narrative play into their philosophy of what D&D is. But even
in my experience,
Go ahead. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Just in my experience, yes, because 3.5 is the only one that I have played as a player.
Okay.
and then Pathfinder, which is like
Pathfinder's just 3.5 reskinned.
3.5 with the serial numbers filed off.
Yeah. I mean, there are important differences, but
yes. But no, that definitely tracks. I think there is more of it in 5e, but I think the quality of storytelling and collaborative storytelling that comes out of 5e in the experience of players is more in the hands of players than it is in the rule book.
Yeah.
And I mean, just to make that distinction.
I have to say this. It's like in my contract. I don't know what contract it is. I don't know when I signed it. But like the thing is, like, if you're playing D&D and you're particularly interested in a narrative story, like there are several lighter weight, similarly fantasy skinned systems that may be able to more efficiently get at that narrative play and enrich that narrative play with like narrative focused mechanics than Wizards of the Coast is necessarily capable of doing. Like, if people enjoy playing D&D, you should play D&D. But I think that this idea that D&D is a good game because we've made it a good game is not necessarily like true.
No, I, as a person who plays a lot of D&D, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I play D&D probably every couple weeks with a group of friends, and it is a good game in the sense that our game is extremely fun. And if other people tried to run our game with different interests or different backgrounds or anything, it would be a different game. And so the good game that we are playing is ours. It is not Wizards of the Coast or even Astrolago Press, who really does incredible work with making great additions to the world of 5e.
I think to bring
But I would like to hear you get into the weeds.
Oh,
sorry.
Do you want to hear me get into the weeds? What were they going to get into the weeds about? Oh, adversarial player relationships. Okay, yeah. So, so there's Call of Cthulhu, which is like you as the GM are actively trying to like drive insane and kill your players. Like, that's your whole job.
Unless you're me.
Well, so in Call of Cthulhu, that is the job of the GM, right? So you, Missy, were not doing that, but you, the impersonal you, who is the GM of a Call of Cthulhu game, playing with the rules as written, that's your job. That's what you're trying to do. That's one thing. I think Call of Cthulhu is of a similar lineage to Dungeons & Dragons, right? Rules as written, 3.5, the Dungeon Master's job is to create puzzles and environments that your players have to engage with and not necessarily conquer, but get through. They have to achieve, you're constructing goals for your players to achieve. And that's very much putting the GM in a separate role from the players. It's giving the GM power over the world that the players do not have, and also giving the GM power over the goal of the story. And the mechanics of play, like the verbs that the players will be engaging with in a way that the players don't have. There are other games like Blades in the Dark, which is a very harsh game, I think. And I played with some friends for a while, and this is something that we ran into, is that the consequences in Blades of the Dark are fairly severe. Your characters are going to have a bad time. And so I think there is, to an extent, an adversarial relationship between the players and not the players, the characters and the environment, or the characters and the game itself. But Blades in the Dark works extremely well when the GM is a fan of the players and is a fan of the story that the whole table is collaboratively telling together. It's not the GM's job to beat the players up, but it is the GM's job to create and design consequences or conflicts that complicate the story that they and the players are telling together. And I think that's a very interesting way to like conceptualize play and player GM relationships. Because Blades in the Dark and Call of Cthulhu are different games, but they require a certain amount of willingness to engage with like characters having a bad day.
I haven't played it yet, but I think this is also true of Bluebeard's Bride.
Yes. Yeah, I haven't read through it. I've read about it some, but it's, yeah, no, you're gonna have a bad day.
Yeah.
It's a bad day game. It's a game about bad days.
And I think that's something that Bo Ruberg touches on in one of the, I think you brought it up as well earlier, the idea that you can still, it is possible to find enjoyment and even pleasure in something that is not actively fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or that feels even destructive.
Yeah. And I want to like, the emotions that they list specifically in this piece that I think are like particularly relevant to Blades in the Dark for me. The total list is annoyance, anger, disappointment, sadness, and hurt are the emotions that are in the like the title of the paper. And I think that Blades in the Dark is a game that invites you to engage with those emotions, whether through the avatar of the player or your character, or through like the story itself. It's not a game that wants players to hurt each other, but it is it's a game that's interested in engaging with hurt as a concept. And that's one of the reasons that when I played it with some friends, our GM was not and is not interested in running a game in which she hurt her players or her players' characters. You know, she's not particularly interested in engaging with games that front hurt quite so much. And so while I had a really good time with Blades in the Dark because I'm interested in engaging with those things, it was a really, really hard game for her to run. And that's like fine. That's just like true about tastes. Like sometimes you have different ones, but it's something that's I think that if I only ever played games that were pleasurable, that were fun, I would feel deeply unfulfilled. And it's something that I bring up when I play games with people, is when I'm playing a long campaign, the thing that I'm most frequently in search of is something that balances the fun and no fun emotions. I'm interested in engaging with sadness and difficult choice, just as much as I'm interested in like making jokes with my friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that idea like competition, if we do want to factor competition into our definition of game, which I don't think is necessary, but I think that competition does not have to look the way that, you know, competitive gaming, our initial impression of competitive gaming is something we do against one another. I think we can also be in competition with one another, not in the traditional like we are also fighting, but we can be in competition together, and we can experience negative, you know, quote unquote negative emotions or experiences together, and that is still an element of friction without necessarily being competition. I threw a lot of words out there, but I think the feeling is there.
Well,
which
it's like, oh God, I don't know if you did this in middle school, but in middle school, I remember this this English class we had where we talked about sources of conflict in stories, and we talked about like, I think it was like man versus man versus environment,
versus
and a third one that I don't remember.
Man versus society, maybe. There's like nature. Yeah. Anyway,
maybe. But I do remember the word man, and I remember reading that and being like, all right, as a 13-year-old or whatever. But I think that's also like a frame that you can apply to games and competition. Is I'm particularly uninterested in games that ask me to compete against other players. But I am interested. I do enjoy games where I compete against the game itself, right? Like Pandemic. Maybe right now is a rough one. but the board game Pandemic, I think, is a really good example because it's intensely collaborative with the other players. Like you and the other players are trying to stop this outbreak. Oh God, this is dark to talk about. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. There is competition. You are trying to win the game. And the thing that you're competing against is the system of the board game itself. And it's a tough competition, which is why I think Pandemic is a particularly interesting example, because it's a hard game. And so this can like extrapolate into video games. I prefer playing collaborative video games. I basically prefer playing collaborative games when we're talking about other players. But segueing into TTRPGs, I'm also very interested in points where players come into comp, not players, ugh, where characters, player characters come into competition, even if I'm not particularly interested in competing against another player. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Because of the story element that goes along with that.
Yeah. So that in our sense. In our Monster Hearts game, my character Morrigan and my friend's character Lucas were frequently at directly opposing odds. and so they would compete, not necessarily like in a sports tournament, but you know, they would have competitions of presence. Particularly because that's how Monster Hearts works, is it has a lot to do with like your character's ability to assert themselves. and so Morrigan and Lucas would go head to head trying to like win an argument. And so they would be competing, but me and my friend Matt, who played Lucas, were absolutely not competing in any way. We were very much collaborating in order to tell this story. Mm-hmm. And so I think competition and kind of conflict are really important parts of play, but absolutely aren't necessary for something to be considered play.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
I also had another thought. Oh wait, oh yeah, this is just very quickly. I also find that when I play competitive games, the primary verb for me stops being play and starts being compete, and I do not enjoy competing as much as I enjoy playing, which I think is why I and the failure to separate those things or prioritize them is maybe like a personal failure, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
I don't think that's unusual. I don't think that's unusual either. Mm. That's something that we have talked about actually in the game of D&D that I play.
Interesting.
Especially because the players all have the same source books that I'm using for our campaign. I mean, aside from the like stuff that I'm adding and subtracting to suit their particular story. But one of the players is like, you know, usually she's like, normally I have a tendency to try to win at all costs, including I could look at the book and see what's going to happen and I could play to my strengths, but I'm not doing that. And I'm like, I appreciate that because that's, you know, like that's helping us tell a story that's going to be exciting for you. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that comes from the way that we have established what play looks like at our table. Mm-hmm. And it's not win.
Yeah.
Should we start wrapping up?
Yes, we should start wrapping up.
What else do we want to hit on before we close?
Let me look at my six notes. Oh, go ahead, Nassim.
Just like the thing that and this is, I think, a longer discussion, so just something to like think about in general, is like two things. One, like, does fun preclude difficulty? Because sometimes I hear, you know, the idea of like quote unquote negative emotions and fun. I'm like, well, but that can heighten the fun. And so I wonder if necessarily it needs to preclude those things, or if whether that's a part of it. And then somewhat related is also like the definition of failure in a game. In general, but specifically in a game, like a game doesn't want you to do a certain thing. For that game, it's like a failure. But if you're choosing to do it, if that's your intent, I'm not, you know, is that a failure? Does that mean you're not having fun? Or does it just mean that you're eschewing the rules that like the game has put forward?
These are both such big questions.
Yeah. Though I mean, it's definitely so like big. I said, like this is just something to think about, not like a let's now start talking about it. But that's like definitely something that I've been thinking about a lot too.
Yeah, I'd love to do.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say I would love to do maybe in the future an episode on like the value of playing against the grain.
Yeah.
And like how that could be fun and that could, simply so I can talk about the time that my husband made his character lay down and skate in the online match and everybody screamed at him.
Oh my god.
Because he made them crash and it was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of fun to be found in specifically failure. And particularly agentive failure. So like failure that you have chosen. But that does really require a certain, like discussing that I think requires a discussion of
yeah,
what
sure.
it means to fail. And yeah. whose definition of failure you're I guess using in a particular mm-hmm. conversation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Much to think about.
Much to as think about.
Billy Ray Cyrus said in that iconic tweet.
Tune in next time on Post Game.
Tune in next time for more Billy Ray Cyrus references.
How many do you have?
Two.
Okay, we'll keep the other one in
two
your back
more
pocket.
Than I do.
That's all I got. We'll keep someday that second one's gonna come up and then you're gonna be like, ah, thank God I waited for that.
There it is.
Do we want, is there anything else that we want to, I love those questions, Nassim, and I'm going to chew on them.
So I'm going to read a sentence. Yep. Nope. Two sentences from Dream Askew, which is one of the first belonging outside belonging games that sort of created the system or the engine. It's by Avery Alder. And Belonging Outside Belonging is a kind of a tabletop RPG engine that has no dice. It uses the phrase "no dice, no masters." It doesn't work with chance. It's just they're pure storytelling games that don't rely on dice or cards or any other sort of like random, I guess, propulsion mechanism. In Belonging Outside Belonging games, you play a character, and each player also kind of takes responsibility for some aspect of world generation. And so the responsibilities and work that would traditionally fall to the GM are split among all of the players. And conflict is driven, again, by all of the players in conversation with each other. Anyway, Dream Askew, one of those. And Avery Alder writes in a section of the book called What a Session is Like, the whole thing wraps up after maybe 3 or 4 hours, that part doesn't matter, and everyone walks away, maybe grinning, maybe with tears in their eyes. Play is rarely done for an audience or a record. It is done just for the fleeting joy of itself.
That's very nice. I like that.
And I think that very much like goes along with a lot of the stuff that we've talked about with regards to play today. Especially not just the play not being done for a record, but also play can result in laughter or in tears, in fun emotions or no fun emotions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's really cool.
It is. I really like that. And I think that that's something that it benefits anybody who is a gamer or a player, or however you want to define that or identify that. I think that that is worthwhile to remember. Obviously, not everybody experiences the same kind of enjoyment from from tears or from laughter.
Yeah. I actually find Belonging Outside Belonging games very, very difficult. I find them to be too loose for me to comfortably generate narrative. But I think the thought process that went into designing them is something I find really, really valuable when thinking about the practice of play.
I think that's really like very good thing to keep in your mind as far as playing, whether alone or with others. What a wonderful note to end on. Thank you, Zora.
Thank you. Thank you, Avery Alder.
Yeah, thank you, Avery Alder, who is not on this podcast, but we very much appreciate your work. So that'll do it for this episode. Much to think about, as the great Billy Ray Cyrus said. You can find us on the internet. You can find Billy Ray Cyrus on the internet, too, if you want more of his wisdom.
I would caution.
I don't know. I don't know what Billy Ray Cyrus is like, aside from that tweet.
I don't either, and I don't really want to know.
Yeah, I think it's better left a mystery. Don't look into Billy Ray Cyrus. Let him exist only as much to think about. You can find us on the internet at sidequest.zone, which is the site that we edit. And it's full of great game criticism and news and stuff like that. And you will like it. And obviously you do like it because you support us on Patreon. Clearly you're getting something out of it. You can find me on the internet at Melissa Brinks on Twitter, where I occasionally pop in and tweet about my dog and then leave.
You can find me at ZH Gilbert, also on Twitter. I do a Kickstarter roundup every month for WAWAC, which is our sister site. I don't know, check that out. There's some good comics on the internet, and there's new ones every month.
It's wild. They just keep coming.
They just keep coming. It's exhausting. It's exciting, but oh my god, there's so many.
I do not do a Kickstarter roundup, but I can be found on the internet at Jamsternazzy.
Wonderful. Thank you to Alexander Nakarada for the use of our theme song, Base Thee, which is used under a Creative Commons Zero license. It's pretty cool. We have a Discord. Come have fun with us in there, posting about animals and games. Believe it or not, we talk about games. And that's going to do it for this episode. Very well. Go take a nap. I'm always so hesitant about
it. You're so scared.
I'm not your mom.
We all need naps, Missy. Good. It's fine. Sometimes you just need permission.
Yeah, I'm giving you permission with my godlike powers as editor-in-chief of Sidequest Unsewn. I'm telling you, go take a nap.
We should try to be wrapping up no later than 1:45.
Perfect. That is 11:45 my time?
10:45.
Okay.
Cool. And that, which means we should actually finish around 2.
Okay.
I know how this goes.
Yes, of course. Of course.
Okay.
I put some notes in there. I don't know how we want to, like...
I put very few notes in there, because I mostly took notes on these pieces of paper, which I know is, like, not a great way to do a podcast, because it means you're going to get to hear me flipping through my paper.
Ambiance.
But I don't... It's been so long since college that I've, like, forgotten how to take notes digitally. Because it requires a certain, like, attention balancing that I'm out of practice on. Anyway, I printed these out.
No, I saw you print those out, and then I was like, fuck, I should be doing that, because I learned so much better from reading a physical thing than from reading a digital thing.
Oh, and yesterday I was having a bad day, attention-wise. It was rough. We have a washing machine that we can hook up to our sink, and I straight up forgot to put the out hose into the sink. It was...
Oh, no!
Yeah, it was bad. It was really bad.
Oh, no.
So I was like, I'm not going to play the game where I try and read something on the internet. With the whole other internet sitting right there.
Yeah, very fair. Do we just kind of want to go through question by question? Do you think that would be useful?
I think what does it mean to play is really huge. So we should try and keep that very, very brief. I don't know. These questions aren't like particularly good for a really tight discussion. They're like the questions that you put at the top of a syllabus for a semester-long course about play, right? Not in any given week of the syllabus.
We will answer these questions definitively in our allotted 1 hour.
Yes, we're going to do it.
You will never have a question about this again. Well, let's just go.
Okay.
See what happens.
Great.
Chaos.
Love it.
Give me two seconds. I'm going to look at a book, because I bookmarked some pages in Dream Askew that have interesting sentences about play.
Oh, I didn't even talk about my experience just reading Variations on Your Body, which I still have not played.
Oh, true. Exciting.
But I don't know. Maybe I have played it.
Okay. I don't think... Maybe you have. I don't think these little passages are necessary. No, I'm going to take it back. I'm going to read one of these.
Do it.